This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, and to find out how you can volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. The History of England from the Accession of James II by Thomas Babington Macaulay. Book 1, Chapter 3, Part 2. The increase of the people has been very great in every part of the kingdom, but generally much greater in the northern than in the southern shires. In truth, a large part of the country beyond Trent was, down to the 18th century, in a state of barbarism. Physical and moral causes had concurred to prevent civilization from spreading to that region. The air was inclement. The soil was generally such as required skilful and industrious cultivation, and there could be little skill or industry in a tract which was often the theatre of war, and which, even when there was nominal peace, was constantly desolated by bands of Scottish marauders, before the union of the two British crowns and long after that union. There was as great a difference between Middlesex and Northumberland as there now is between Massachusetts and the settlements of those squatters who, far to the west of the Mississippi, administer a rude justice with the rifle and the dagger. In the reign of Charles II, the traces left by ages of slaughter and pillage were distinctly perceptible, many miles south of the Tweed, in the face of the country, and in the lawless manners of the people. There was still a large class of moss troopers, whose calling was to plunder dwellings and to drive away whole herds of cattle. It was found necessary, soon after the Restoration, to enact laws of great severity for the prevention of these outrages. The magistrates of Northumberland and Cumberland were authorised to raise bands of armed men for the defence of property, and order and provision was made for meeting the expense of these levies by local taxation. The parishes were required to keep bloodhounds for the purpose of hunting the freebooters. Many old men who were living in the middle of the 18th century could well remember the time when those ferocious dogs were common. Yet even with such auxiliaries, it was often found impossible to track the robbers to their retreats among the hills and morasses, for the geography of that wild country was very imperfectly known. Even after the accession of George III, the path over the fells from Borrowdale to Ravenglass was still a secret, carefully kept by the dalesmen, some of whom had probably in their youth escaped from the pursuit of justice by that road. The seats of the gentry and the larger farmhouses were fortified. Oxen were penned at night beneath the overhanging battlements of the residence, which was known by the name of the Peel. The inmates slept with arms at their sides. Huge stones and boiling water were in readiness to crush and scald the plunderer, who might venture to assail the little garrison. No traveller ventured into that country without making his will. The judges on circuit, with the whole body of barristers, attorneys, clerks, and serving men, rode on horseback from Newcastle to Carlisle, armed and escorted by a strong guard under the command of the sheriffs. It was necessary to carry provisions, for the country was a wilderness which afforded no supplies. The spot where the cavalcade halted to dine, under an immense oak, is not yet forgotten. The irregular vigour with which criminal justice was administered shocked observers whose lives had been passed in more tranquil districts. Juries, animated by hatred and by a sense of common danger, convicted housebreakers and cattle-stealers with the promptitude of a court-martial in a mutiny, and the convicts were hurried by scores to the gallows. Within the memory of some whom this generation has seen, the sportsmen who wandered in pursuit of game to the sources of the Tyne found the heaths round Kildare Castle peopled by a race scarcely less savage than the Indians of California, and heard with surprise the half-naked women chanting a wild measure while the men with brandished dirks danced a war dance. Slowly and with difficulty, peace was established on the border. In the train of peace came industry and all the arts of life. Meanwhile, it was discovered that the regions north of the Trent possessed in their coal beds a source of wealth far more precious than the gold mines of Peru. It was found that in the neighbourhood of these beds almost every manufacturer might be most profitably carried on. A constant stream of emigrants began to roll northward. It appeared by the returns of 1841 that the ancient archiepiscopal province of York contained 2/7 of the population of England. At the time of the Revolution, that province was believed to contain only 1/7 of the population. In Lancashire, the number of inhabitants appeared to have increased 9-fold, while in Norfolk, Suffolk, and Northamptonshire, it has hardly doubled. Of the taxation, we can speak with more confidence and precision than of the population. The revenue of England when Charles II died was small when compared with the resources which she even then possessed, or with the sums which were raised by the governments of the neighbouring countries. It had, from the time of the Restoration, been almost constantly increasing, yet it was little more than 3/4 of the revenue of the United Provinces, and was hardly 1/5 of the revenue of France. The most important head of receipt was the excise, which in the last year of the reign of Charles produced £585,000, clear of all deductions. The net proceeds of the customs amounted in the same year to £530,000. These burdens did not lie very heavy on the nation. The tax on chimneys, though less productive, called forth far louder murmurs. The discontent excited by direct imposts is, indeed, almost always out of proportion to the quantity of money which they bring into the exchequer. And the tax on chimneys was, even among direct imposts, peculiarly odious, for it could be levied only by means of domiciliary visits, and of such visits the English have always been impatient to a degree which the people of other countries can but faintly conceive. The poorer householders were frequently unable to pay their hearth money to the day. When this happened, their furniture was distrained without mercy, for the tax was farmed, and a farmer of taxes is, of all creditors, proverbially the most rapacious. The collectors were loudly accused of performing their unpopular duty with harshness and insolence. It was said that as soon as they appeared at the threshold of a cottage, the children began to wail, and the old women ran to hide their earthenware. Nay, the single bed of a poor family had sometimes been carried away and sold. The net annual receipt from this tax was £200,000. When to the three great sources of income which have been mentioned we add the royal domains, then far more extensive than at present, the first fruits and tenths which had not yet been surrendered to the church, the duchies of Cornwall and Lancaster, the forfeitures and the fines, we shall find that the whole annual revenue of the crown may be fairly estimated at about £1,400,000. Of this revenue, part was hereditary. The rest had been granted to Charles for life, and he was at liberty to lay out the whole exactly as he thought fit. Whatever he could save by retrenching from the expenditure of the public departments was an addition to his privy purse. At the post office, more will hereafter be said. The profits of that establishment had been appropriated by Parliament to the Duke of York. The King's revenue was, or rather ought to have been, charged with the payment of about £80,000 a year. The interest of the sum fraudulently destined in the exchequer by the cabal. While Danby was at the head of the finances, the creditors had received dividends, though not with the strict punctuality of modern times. But those who had succeeded him at the Treasury had been less expert, or less solicitous to maintain public faith. Since the victory won by the court over the Whigs, not a farthing had been paid, and no redress was granted to the sufferers, till a new dynasty had been many years on the throne. There can be no greater error than to imagine that the device of meeting the exigences of the state by loans was imported into our island by William III. What really dates from his reign is not the system of borrowing, but the system of funding. From a period of immemorable antiquity, it had been the practice of every English government to contract debts. What the Revolution introduced was the practice of honestly paying them. By plundering the public creditor, it was possible to make an income of about £1,400,000, with some occasional help from Versailles support the necessary charges of the government and the wasteful expenditure of the court. For that load which pressed most heavily on the finances of the great continental states was here scarcely felt. In France, Germany, and the Netherlands, armies such as Henry IV and Philip II had never employed in time of war were kept in the midst of peace. Bastions and ravelin were everywhere rising, constructed on principles unknown to Parma and Spinola. Stores of artillery and ammunition were accumulated, such as even Richelieu, whom the preceding generation had regarded as a worker of prodigies, would have pronounced fabulous. No man could journey many leagues in those countries without hearing the drums of a regiment on march, or being challenged by the sentinels on the drawbridge of a fortress. In our island, on the contrary, it was possible to live long and to travel far without being once reminded by any martial sight or sound that the defence of the nations had become a science and a calling. The majority of Englishmen who were under 25 years of age had probably never seen a company of regular soldiers. Of the cities, which in the Civil War had valiantly repelled hostile armies, scarcely one was now capable of sustaining a siege. The gates stood open night and day, the ditches were dry, the ramparts had been suffered to fall into decay, or were repaired only that the townsfolk might have a pleasant walk on summer evenings. Of the old baronial keeps, many had been shattered by the cannon of Fairfax and Cromwell, and lay in heaps of ruin, overgrown with ivy. Those which remained had lost their martial character, and were now rural palaces of the aristocracy. The moats were turned to preserves of carp and pike. The mounds were planted with fragrant shrubs, through which spiral walks ran up to summer houses, adorned with mirrors and paintings. On the capes of the sea coast and on many inland hills were still seen tall posts, surmounted by barrels. Once these barrels had been filled with pitch. Watchmen had been set around them in seasons of danger, and, within a few hours after a Spanish sail had been discovered in the channel, or after 1,000 Scottish moss troopers had crossed the Tweed, the signal fires were blazing 50 miles off, and whole counties were rising in arms. But many years had now elapsed since the beacons had been lighted, and they were regarded rather as curious relics of ancient manners than as parts of a machinery necessary to the safety of the state. End of part 2.